for sustained temperatures over 31, those conditions are getting dangerous for people who are susceptible to heat. And this home was at those high temperatures for fully 4 days during the event. These are data from a colleague. They were presented at the knowledge exchange with Ministry of Health a couple of weeks back. Doctors Corinne Hall and Kira Gothic-Keenan are ER physicians who had the opportunity to do a chart review of all patients who presented to the ER with heat stroke, and a pretty technical definition of heat stroke, which is a very severe illness. And what it helps to illustrate is that some of the same patterns here that we see here are consistent with the mortality data. So in the first couple of days of this event, not a lot going on. It starts to build on the third day, and we see that the later evening hours are when most of these presentations occur. And then we see the same thing on this fourth day. So again, just indicative that these indoor temperatures are really starting to affect the health of people by the days 3 and 4 roll around of the event. So the studies that we have published or worked on recently are all looking at different comorbidities or different health conditions that put people at risk during the heat dome. And in this study, what we did was compare everybody who died during the heat dome with the people who had died on the same days of the year in previous years. So we're comparing people who are dead with other people who are dead, but with the hopes of looking for differences between those two groups that'll help us to highlight the reasons that people die during the heat dome. And if you look at this image here, what you see is this is the heat dome period, and these are all the other years that we're comparing with back to 2012. We went as far back as necessary to get 4 deaths for every heat dome death that occurred. And you know, there's no extreme weather events during any of these periods. There's a few days here and there with statistically significant excess mortality, but not, you know, not anything that's abnormal. And what we ended up doing was comparing 612 deaths during the heat dome. Again, it's all deaths, it's not just the excess deaths, with 6,500 deaths that occurred in these prior years. And when we do that, what we found is the biggest difference between the groups was the presence of schizophrenia. So when we look at the results here, we can see that schizophrenia is just way above any of these other conditions that people might have. We also see a significant effect of chronic kidney disease, an elevated but not significant effect of ischemic stroke, ischemic heart disease here, substance use disorder, but you know, schizophrenia is just set far apart from any of these other potential risks. And although I'm not showing you those results, we found this was true for, you know, people who had died of the heat, according to the BC Coroner's Service, and people who had not died of the heat, the people who had died from other causes. We still saw that there was a higher prevalence of schizophrenia among those heat dome decedents. And you know, there's almost a threefold increase in risk here, and the important question is why. And we hypothesized that this is, you know, a bunch of multiple overlapping and complex risk factors. So individuals with schizophrenia are generally not as aware of their health status as people without the disease. It's a condition called anosognosia, and up to 90% of people with schizophrenia will demonstrate anosognosia. So people simply may not recognize that they are too hot and potentially fatally too hot. Schizophrenia is associated with economic marginalization and social isolation, and both of those things are risk factors for death during hot weather, even independent of schizophrenia. It's also associated with other comorbidities, some of which are due to pharmacological treatments. Those include heart disease, diabetes, and then we do see a higher prevalence of substance use disorder among this population. And finally, schizophrenia is managed in many cases with medications that can affect thermoregulation. So the next study we did was kind of similar, but instead of comparing those who died during the heat dome, we compared them with people who survived the heat dome, but who were kind of comparable on paper. So if somebody died as an inpatient in the hospital, we compared them with other inpatients in hospital that were the same age and the same sex and living in the same region. And in this study, we wanted, again, to kind of confirm the results of the prior study and do a deeper dive into socioeconomic deprivation. And the way that we evaluate that at an individual level is via PharmaNet, or the pharmaceuticals that folks had dispensed to them. And we know that if someone has a medication dispensed under Plan C, that they are receiving income assistance from the province. And we know that that level of income assistance is actually below the poverty line. So these are people who are likely living in poverty. Now, not everybody had had a prescription dispensed within the past year. Most of the cases and controls had, but a small portion had not. And that means that we don't know whether or not they were receiving income assistance. But among those who had had a prescription, we do see that about 15% of the cases were on income assistance, compared with just over 6% of the controls. So quite a big difference between these two groups. And when we repeat the similar analyses, once again, we find that schizophrenia is the most prevalent difference between those people who died and those people who survived. We also see chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, Parkinson's, heart failure, chronic kidney disease, ischemic stroke, and substance use disorder as being significantly associated with risk of death during the heat dome. Now, these green dots show us the effect for schizophrenia here, adjusted for the presence of all of these other conditions. And the blue dot shows us schizophrenia adjusted for the presence of all of these other conditions and whether or not the individual was on Plan C. And in most cases, we see that accounting for Plan C leads to a very small adjustment in these two dots. But in two cases, we see quite a downward adjustment. So here for schizophrenia, when we adjust for Plan C, the estimate ends up here. And when we adjust for Plan C in substance use disorder, the estimate ends up here. And what that's telling us is a big part of this effect is actually due to poverty. And when we account for poverty, this is the truer effect of schizophrenia, and this is the truer effect of substance use disorder. And just to show that a little more clearly, in this plot, we have the same types of analysis. In this case, the blue dot is adjusted for Plan C, and the purple dot is adjusted for the deprivation in the surrounding area. We don't see very big differences between those two estimates. And this shows us the effect of Plan C adjusted for all of these conditions. So what it's telling us is that the poverty is the biggest risk factor here. And then, you know, we get into these specific health conditions. And then finally, we wanted to do a deeper dive into these individuals who did have schizophrenia to understand what the risks were, and particularly to look at that question of the antipsychotic medications. So antipsychotic drugs are used to manage psychoses for people who have schizophrenia, which is really defined by the presence of psychoses. And there's two types of drugs. What's known as first generation drugs were developed quite early in the 50s and 60s, when these are often called typical antipsychotics, and they act specifically on dopamine. And then the second generation drugs were developed more in the 80s. They're called the atypical antipsychotics, and they both act on dopamine and serotonin. Now, any drug that acts on dopamine is going to have side effects, and those side effects include the inhibition of sweating and dysregulation of sort of central temperature control or thermoregulation. So we definitely know that both of these generations of drugs have those side effects, and the side effects tend to be more potent in the first generation, the ones that only act on dopamine, than they are in the second generation, which act on both dopamine and serotonin. And in this case, we compared all of the individuals with schizophrenia who died during the heat dome with all of the individuals in BC with schizophrenia who survived the heat dome, and with the individuals with schizophrenia who died in the year prior to the heat dome. So in this case, we're kind of combining both of those different study designs that we discussed previously. And when we look at these three groups of people, we see there were 134 people with schizophrenia who died during the heat dome, and 80% of them had been dispensed some kind of antipsychotic medication in the 90 days before their death. So a very high proportion were on these antipsychotic medications. Among the population that survived, more than 52,000 people, 55% had been dispensed a medication in the 90 days before the heat dome. And for those who died in the prior year, just over 1,300 people, 68% had been dispensed one of these medications within 3 months of their deaths. And when we look at these results, the blue dot is comparing those who died during the heat dome with those who survived, and the brown dot is comparing those who died during the heat dome with those who died in the previous year. In both cases, we see that the dispensation of an antipsychotic medication was significantly associated with higher risk of death, with a threefold difference among the decedents and the survivors. We also see that male sex was somewhat associated with risk, living longer with schizophrenia even after being adjusted for age. And then what's kind of interesting is the impacts of having had an inpatient visit for schizophrenia, maybe a marker of the severity of disease, and the number of outpatient visits. Those don't really have very big effects compared with these other factors. Now, there's two places where the results are divergent for the two comparator groups, and that is for age and for substance use disorder. And the reason for this is that because people with schizophrenia who died in the year preceding the heat dome were typically younger than those who died during the heat dome, and typically had a higher proportion of substance use disorder, that makes the age and substance use disorder appear somewhat protective when we're using this comparison group. But it's important to note that in this group of people, we did not remove deaths from things such as suicide or homicide or all of the types of deaths that may be more prevalent among people with schizophrenia than among the general population. So a quick summary of those results is we did see that antipsychotic medications were associated with increased risk, and the degree of risk depended on the comparison group. And we also saw that almost all of the antipsychotics that we evaluated were associated with increased risk. You're not a clinical audience, so we didn't run through all the different types of medications, but pretty much all of them had some association. And, you know, the important piece of this is that antipsychotic medication is clearly a risk factor, when it comes to extreme heat, but it's also a very important and life-saving part of schizophrenia treatment. So, you know, we certainly don't want to recommend that people stop their medications or modify their therapeutic regime in any way. We really do need to focus on those other risk factors that we talked about, those the social isolation, the economic marginalization, lack of access to air conditioning. None of these deaths would occur if people were in safe indoor environments. And you know, there's lots of opportunities to help raise the profile of this information. Especially, we noted that 65% of those who died had seen a physician for a schizophrenia-related visit in the year prior to their deaths. So just a summary of everything I've told you. What put people at highest risk of death during the heat dome? That's the question we set out to answer. And the number one answer is really poverty. After that, schizophrenia and everything associated with schizophrenia, COPD, Parkinson's, heart failure, chronic kidney disease, ischemic stroke, substance use disorder. Many of those things are typically on the list when we talk about those who are susceptible to extreme heat, but you rarely see people with schizophrenia at the top of that list. We also found that if people had more comorbidities or more conditions, they were at higher risk. And then there were these neighborhood factors that we had seen in previous studies, you know, neighborhoods with more material deprivation, more social deprivation, and less green space. So I just want to give a shout out to the folks who manage the data platform that we were able to use for these very in-depth analyses and very informative analyses, I think, and happy to take any questions now or later, depending on how the organizers want to go.
Don't see any questions that I don't see any in the chat anyway, so let's move on. And we'll, if there's any questions, certainly put them in the chat and we can get to them after. Thank you, Dr. Henderson. And we'll go to Lara quickly.
I'll just get my screen up here for you. So I will try and be brief, and hopefully we won't be repeating too much of what you heard last year. So first of all, I just want to acknowledge that I'm joining you today from the Ministry of Health offices here in Victoria, located on the traditional lands of the Lekwungen people of the Esquimalt and the Songhees First Nations. Also to acknowledge the Métis Chartered Community of Victoria and to thank them for allowing myself to work the play on the land. So, to situate everyone, we'll just give you a bit of background on the extreme heat impacts from 2022, as well as a bit of the development of the BC Heat Committee and BC HARS, and then to update everyone on some of the changes to the HARS that are coming this month and in June. So a bit of the background on the triggers, the activation process, and messaging examples, just to remind everyone that we did work there. In addition, to highlight what we've heard for 2022 and what we're adding to our forthcoming HARDs for next month. So just to give a bit of background, really high level, so summer 2022 was our first year with the BC HARDs in place. Just to emphasize though, there were no extreme heat emergency alerts issued in BC. From June to September 22, there were 6 heat warnings issued, and these ranged from 2 to 8 days in length. As you might recall, there is that extended heat that happened last July, August, that was between the 25th of July to the 1st of August. This is something that the Heat Committee really closely monitored, both for its regularity and length of the event, but also that the overnight lows really weren't coming down as we had previously experienced, and that's, as Sarah sort of pointed out, really where the danger happens. Pardon me. So 40 forecast regions were impacted by that extended heat event, and July 26th we saw 14 maximum temperature records were either tied or broken across the province. So really, really not significant from a health perspective, but significant in terms of how unusual this event was. Just to situate everyone, so the Heat Committee was instituted last January 2022, so not that long. It's co-led by the Ministry of Health and the BC Center for Disease Control, Sarah being one of our co-chairs. It also is comprised of public health experts in all of the health authorities, as well as First Nations Health Authority, members of BC, EHS, and too many more to list. We also have a member of the UBCM that's sitting as an observer at the moment, which is great. The committee was established to support the planning and response efforts related to public health impacts for significant heat events. The primary objective, you know, was of the committee was to ensure that public health coordination around extreme hot weather existed. Pardon me, let's go back. And that the objective for the committee was to ensure that public health coordination around extreme hot weather existed in the province, and from that we developed heat alert response system for June 2022 and subsequent years. The HARP, as you may recall, details heat warning and the more serious, more extreme heat emergency. And it also identified different public health actions and messaging to reduce heat-related illness and mortality. So just showing up on the slide here are some examples of documents that sort of informed the development of the HARS and as to why it was so important to have this in place. So, BC HARS. You'll see here, and you may recall, that BC divided up into sort of five ECCC heat warning criteria regions. So those are just listed there on the, so things like Southwest, Fraser, Southeast, that sort of thing. You'll see the heat warning trigger temperatures. It's a high, low, high. So 2 days at a specific temperature maximum and 2 days or 1 day of a temperature overnight low. Just for everyone's awareness, there's no changes to our extreme heat emergency criteria, so the more dangerous criteria there. However, for 2023, we are proposing that the Heat Committee would, in the instance of, pardon me, sorry, I've been a bit ill today. For 2023, there's an additional criteria that's been added in the instance of after the third heat event of the season in a given forecast region, where the BC Heat Coordinating Committee may recommend extending that minimum number of days for a heat warning by 1 day in that specific region. So that would be 3 or more consecutive daytime high temperatures, and then two or more where the T-max value for the overnight low is expected to only reach those specific criteria. Different consideration would come into play, you know, for this, whether it was whether a similar region had experienced, you know, confounding impacts, or there's different criteria at play here, whether that would go forward as a recommendation. But so this is something that we are putting into play for this year after the third heat warning event in that respective forecast region. Just trying to situate everyone here, so perhaps you can identify what criteria you may be sitting in. So this is the map on our left here, which shows the different ECCC heat warning criteria regions that I just spoke about. And in green, you'll see the health authority lines. Next to it, there on the table, you can see how the five different regions are split up, and it also details some of the communities that would be falling into that criteria. So just trying to make sure everyone is aware of where they may be according to the different criteria regions. And again, trying to situate us all, this map on the right also shows some of the electoral districts listed in red. And if you're more familiar with the emergency management and climate readiness criteria, that's listed there. So showing their different regions, the Northwest, Northeast, and that sort of a thing. There's so many different regional variations. I just wanted to make sure everyone was aware of how ECCC's regions fit in with what they may be familiar with already. So just a quick algorithm of the HARS escalation process. So as a reminder, this was developed in partnership with our colleagues over at Environment Climate Change Canada and BC Coordinating Committee. It leverages the existing emergency management climate readiness regional communication structure to support coordination calls with partners, and it includes new revised language, as they're referred to, so after that third heat event of the season. So this is sort of a summary of what was previously detailed in the last couple slides and on the next slide, so I won't spend too much time on that. So just to give everyone an example of what would be going on from both the ECCC side and from the BC Heat Committee side. So in the instance that there's a heat warning or a heat warning is expected, there would be ECCC would be sending their internal facing weather notification to the different emergency managers and strategic partners indicating the duration of event. Then there would be a public facing heat warning, usually sent 1 to 2 days before, also indicating the duration of the event. Had this been a first event of the season, there's often a special weather statement, which many of you may have seen the last week when it was sent out. The Health Authority MHO may recommend that EMCR would hold a coordination call if the impacted area does not normally experience heat events or if there's multiple simultaneous events impacting that region. If this were like a standard heat warning, members of the BC Heat Committee would just be monitoring the situation and the Secretariat would be informing the group about any significant changes. If it's indicated that this was an anomalous event, sort of like we experienced last summer, or if there's an indication that this could evolve into an extreme heat emergency, there is a BC Heat Operations Subcommittee that would be activated and would gather. So this is representation from like EMCR operations, BC Housing, ECCC, BC CDC, health authorities, NBC, provincial health officer, as well as FNHA, emergency services, and communications. So if this was an extreme event, extreme heat event, that was falling into the category of an extreme heat emergency, ECCC notification would be sent and the heat committee would be advising EMCR to issue the broadcast intrusive alert via Alert Ready. So our lovely tables, just as showing this as a reminder that at the back of the HARS document, there are tables with recommended key messages that we encourage all of us to use and refer to more consistent messaging. These are standardized recommended messaging, and they're broken down into pre-season for a heat warning, an extreme heat emergency. And that last column on this page here is some key messages regarding air quality during an extreme heat emergency. The tables have been updated to integrate some feedback we received from the after action review we did post-summer, and we are planning to do further refinements as we get more input and feedback. Showing an example of the recommended actions for local authorities and Indigenous communities. Just to let everyone remind everyone that there are these tables for public health, health authorities, hospitals, and community care sites, pre-hospital care, so the BCEHS primarily, for ministries, and then for EMCR and Ministry of Health, this table here, which is local authorities, Indigenous communities, as well as a table for NGOs and partner organizations. And some updates about that are going into the HARS for 2023. So just based on feedback that we've had this year and last year, just a reminder that the HARS is really an evergreen document. The first update will be out later in May, and then additional materials and appendices will be added as items are approved. So the updates we noted in the summary provisions, just to make sure it's very clear and explicit what the changes are, just in case you're looking at or you're more familiar with the previous version. So some changes by the summer include guidance on a base level of response and inclusion of sort of these quick start guides, including checklists per table of recommendations. We're including some additions to the appendix, so the communications templates, glossary, and the summary of revisions. We've really tried to simplify the trigger and escalation process and to parse out the recommendations so it's clearer who would have the different roles and responsibilities. So as of May, formal and informal feedback, as well as targeted engagement with many key partners and interested parties was conducted. We did close our survey on April 28th, which hopefully most of you did receive information about. The recommendations will be integrated into a What You Heard report, so that's coming out in June, and we also plan to do an update to the HARs sort of by mid-June based on what those recommendations are. We do plan, however, for there to be further consultation and definitely more robust and more fulsome engagement, particularly with local authorities, Indigenous partners, and First Nations leadership. That's being planned for the fall 2023. Just a quick summary slide here of some of the tools and resources. Our partners over at BMCR have the Extreme Heat Preparedness Guide, which is a great tool. NCCH has a really useful checklist that can be used for doing check-ins during an extreme heat event. And we have some knowledge translation tools for just giving examples of what the susceptible populations are, as well as the differences between a heat warning and an extreme heat emergency. Just to also note that Best Practices Resources Toolkit will be coming out later on in June. And as Sarah said, perhaps we'll leave questions to the end, but happy to take them now, and happy also to receive feedback via email or to get on a call. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thank you. I don't see any questions in the Q&A, so let's go on to Anna Bunce, and we'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much. I believe I'm now sharing my screen. Can everyone see that? Excellent. Okay. And I just have to get up. Where is it? Here we go. So thanks everyone. My presentation will be a little less data heavy. My name is Anna Bunce, and I'm a senior policy analyst with the Ministry of Health Climate Resilience Unit. And I'd really like to thank everyone for making the time today to have this presentation. I know it's a bit of a repeat, and hopefully I'm not repeating too much that folks already know. But I'm really appreciative of this opportunity to give a bit of an introduction to our team and what work we're doing and the ways in which we're working to address how climate change is impacting our health here in BC. I'd like to acknowledge with deep gratitude and respect that I'm joined today from my home here in Esquimalt, which is on the beautiful territory of the Lekwungen and Speak peoples, known today as the Songkhla and Esquimalt First Nations. And I'm also lucky to live in a community that is home to the Métis Chart community in Greater Victoria. I also really want to take a moment to acknowledge and honor the amazing climate leadership we see among Indigenous communities here in British Columbia. Our Indigenous leaders and community members have been making great strides when it comes to climate action for a long time, and have had a very strong understanding of the integral connection between environment and health since time immemorial, and I think in many ways we're all just catching up. So a little about our program, our team. So in June of 2022, so almost a year ago, the Ministry of Health established a climate resilience unit to support and coordinate the implementation of the Ministry of Health's commitments under the Provincial Climate Preparedness and Adaptation Strategy. And under this strategy, the Ministry of Health and our health authorities are working to advance foundational actions to protect, promote population health, and also strengthen our health system's capacity to anticipate, respond, cope, and recover, and ultimately adapt to the climate-related shocks and stressors that we've been experiencing, such as the heat event in 2021. Ultimately, the work is to improve our population's health despite the unstable climate. And this work is what the World Health Organization refers to as health systems climate resilience, and this is our team's ultimate goal. This work certainly exists within a broader landscape, so I just want to take a moment to kind of situate where our team sits in the broader provincial climate landscape. So as I mentioned, our team received funding and came about as a result of the Climate Preparedness and Adaptation Strategy. The CPAS, or Climate Preparedness and Adaptation Strategy, provided us with the funding to be able to fund climate positions in each of the province's health authorities. So there's now a staff member dedicated to looking at climate and health in each health region across the province. And I'd be happy to connect with you after and connect you to the climate lead in your health region if that would be useful for you. The Climate Preparedness and Adaptation Strategy itself exists under this larger umbrella of the Clean BC Strategy, which is a provincial strategy looking at climate mitigation, so reducing our emissions as well as adaptation. And there's also the Climate Ready BC website that just recently launched, and I'd invite you to have a look at that if you are not already familiar. So our team exists within this this ecosystem, and we really see our role as being that of a bridge and a role to link our health system partners and other ministries working in this climate space to make sure that we're bringing a strong health presence into those initiatives and a strong climate presence into health initiatives. So for example, you might be aware that the newly formed Emergency Management and Climate Readiness Ministry is embarking on a disaster and climate risk and resilience assessment. And we know that this will really benefit from being informed by the regional health authorities' health vulnerability and adaptation assessments that those climate leads in each of the health authorities are leading. So we really see our role as being one to connect folks. So I think we're all coming around to the increasing understanding that and awareness and recognition that climate change is not just an environmental issue, but also critical to our health and wellness as well. And the World Health Organization has declared that the greatest threat to human health is climate change. And we see BC's health system and our communities as being increasingly challenged by the health impacts of climate change. As I mentioned, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities have long recognized that human health and wellness really can't be separated from the health of our environment, and that there are complex intersecting factors that really shape our health and wellness. And I think that's beautifully illustrated in this graphic, which you may be familiar with, the First Nations Health Authority, which really reinforces this need for collaboration to bring together diverse expertise, diverse lived experience, and a diversity in terms of our ways of knowing, so that we're better able to respond to climate change. So, with that big challenge ahead of us, how are we going to build a more resilient and responsive health system in the face of this changing climate? Well, our program has five key goals, and these are to work to strengthen our health sector climate leadership and governance, to work to enhance our health system workforce knowledge, capacity, and resources when it comes to climate change and how climate change impacts health. We're looking to advance and enhance knowledge, data, and evidence to inform policy and practice, and like I said, not just climate policy, but also health policy, bringing health into climate and climate into health. We're working to empower and engage communities to prepare as they work to prepare and adapt to climate change. So conversations such as these, I would encourage you to reach out if there's a way we can also help to empower and engage you when it comes to your own preparedness and adaptation planning and bringing health into that. And then finally, we're looking to systematically integrate a climate and health lens into policy and practice. So those are some big goals, and we know they can't be met without a cross-sectoral and all of society approach. So we're taking a very collaborative approach across our regional and provincial health authorities, and then working with other partners such as government, Indigenous communities, local governments such as yourselves, and partners in academia. And over the past year, we've been working very closely with our health authorities and other key partners to really identify what are the areas where BC's health sector can best support the province's response to climate preparedness and adaptation, and then to identify and form the partnerships that will be critical to this work. ultimately we know that working with other partners and centers is going to be essential. So with that, I'd just like to again thank you for your time. And as I said, we do aim to play that bridging role, and I encourage you to reach out if you'd like to connect with us or be put in contact with the climate lead for your health region. Please don't hesitate to send us an email at this email address at the bottom, healthclimateresilience@gov.bc.ca. And with that, I'll hand it back. Thank you so much.
There we go. Thank you. Hugely informative and really great to have all three of your perspectives here. Are there any questions from anybody watching today? I believe you just pop it in the chat or you can raise your hand. Am I right about that, Marilyn? Okay. So if anybody has any questions, experts here who have also offered their contact information if you wish to take this offline and connect with them. I see Margaret Skaya. I hope I'm saying that right. Do I need to do anything to allow Margaret to speak? Marilyn?
I don't think people can speak in the webinar setting. I think they can only ask questions via the question, like typed question and answers, but I'm not positive about that.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
A screen came up and it said unmute. I guess I hit the right one. Yeah, Margaret Scott. I'm a counselor in Silverton, BC, in the interior. Very, very small town, 150 people. So I'm just wondering, have there been any particular recommendations for such isolated communities as we have with a very intermittent, unstable ER situation, very limited healthcare facilities at this moment, and transportation is a big issue. And there are a lot of isolated seniors on low incomes.
Perfect. Thank you. And I should have said before you asked your question, but for the sake of everybody else, just so you know, this session is being recorded and will be posted to our website and to the YouTube page. I'll turn the question over to whoever would like to answer that question. Thank you.
Laura, go ahead.
I might just briefly jump in there. To respond to Margaret, first on the small point of definitely that we've been trying to think about how can, say, a community with less resources or perhaps less physical infrastructure respond to a heat event, how can they prepare their community for that? So we've been trying to think a little bit out of the box and are recommending things like, is there a communal outdoor space that is a natural gathering space for your community that could perhaps be used as a cooling space or even just a space to provide information and update people on how they can keep themselves safe in the event of an extreme heat emergency. So those considerations are happening and definitely more work needs to happen. We do have, I think, just one small section on how one of your other communities in the interior is using the HARS and there in sort of for a smaller community. So that is there as a reference, but definitely, Margaret, we're trying to be cognizant of making sure that differently resourced communities can effectively take care of themselves.
Great, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The only piece that I would add is, you know, another tool that small communities and that we all have at our hands is check-ins and just kind of ensuring that community network exists so that, you know, you've identified the people in the community who are isolated seniors and who would benefit from a phone call or a quick visit a few times a day to see how they're coping with these hot conditions if there is no opportunity for you know, gathering in a community space or what have you.
Thank you. I have a question from Sarah. How are nonprofit organizations being involved in the planning process?
don't have any of those.
Just to check, would that be for the HARS planning, I suppose? I can answer short, obviously, in that context. Well, I will say we did do a targeted survey, which just closed in April, and there is plans for a more fulsome engagement, which would be one-on-one and more directed to NGOs that work with our susceptible populations, and that's how we would really want to hear individuals' feedback and individuals' experiences that way. So that's unfortunately not until the fall, but however, I'm going to add my details here and always happy to start that discussion earlier.
Great, thank you. Anna, did you want to add to it?
Yeah, I'd just add that, you know, in our work we recognize that nonprofit organizations play a huge role in terms of responding during climate-related crises like heat. And we're at a point where we're working to gather together a better understanding of how climate change is impacting health in British Columbia. And we've been reaching out to various nonprofits to have discussions about how what their experiences have been during events such as the heat dome. So definitely learning from them and bringing their voices to increase our understanding.
Great, thank you. Our next question is from Sarah. Besides eliminating poverty, which seems like a tall order, what are the most important elements of a cooling space? In the shade, cool drinks, or other elements that you can recommend?
Well, first of all, there's just a lot of people named Sarah involved here today.
There always is.
Or if you're talking about an outdoor cooling space, which it does sound like is what's being asked here, shade nearby water is, if there's a stream or a fountain or something like that, that will help to improve the evaporative cooling. A breeze, so a place that is breezy is often quite helpful. And then if we are talking about outdoor cooling, provision of water both for drinking and for soaking things down with. So, you know, cold water bucket where you could soak a t-shirt or a towel or a bandana to kind of cool off all those hot pieces. Those are all useful for outdoor cooling stations, as well as somewhere to sit and relax.
Cool.
I'd also add that when looking at cooling spaces, be they inside or outside, be thinking about accessibility as well and whether people feel safe gathering in that space. I think Lara made a really great point about thinking about what are those natural cooling spaces that already exist where people like to congregate when it's hot. I mean, as a teenager, I worked in a movie theater. We were always the busiest in the summer on the hottest days because of the air conditioning. So, you know, keeping in mind that accessibility plays mind whether or not people feel safe and who may not feel safe in that space, and having a diversity of spaces and a variety of neighborhoods for people to go to is also ideal.
That's a really good point. Something that we encountered here in my community when we opened a cold center when it got to minus 30 at night, we people assumed that the local school, which was closed for Christmas holidays, you know, why not use the school as a space? But some people are prohibited from entering school spaces that are owned by school district property. So, you know, that's something to consider, and it's not always obvious. So really being mindful about that safe space and creating a couple of options, as you say, and I know that's harder to do in small communities, but really useful to keep in the back of your mind when you're making these plans. And I think nonprofits really have a touch point with the community that they serve that can really benefit local priorities and local planning considerations when you go into these spaces. So thanks for that answer. Are there any other questions from any of the attendees? Or anything that any of the presenters would like to add at this point?
It's wrapping up. Bam.
I'll just reiterate a big thank you to everyone for making the time today. really great, important work that the BCCDC and our emergency management colleagues are leading here when it comes to health. And it's just great to have this opportunity to get to speak directly with municipalities. So thank you.
Thank you. And for anyone who is watching, you can access this recording later on. It will be posted to our website. I also wanted to share at this time a big thank you to our presenters and to everyone who attended today. I would also like to remind that UBCM administers an extreme temperature risk mapping, assessment, and planning funding program. This funding program supports local governments to ensure that they have accurate knowledge of the risks associated with extreme temperatures and how those risks will change over time, and to develop effective response plans and strategies to prepare, mitigate, and adapt to those risks. This funding program is currently accepting applications, and the deadline is June 2nd, so just over a week away. Thank you again, and if you have any follow-up questions or comments, please reach out to UBCM, and we look forward to hopefully no heat domes this summer, and I hope that you all are staying safe where you are, and we really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen Ford.
Thank you, everyone.
And thanks. Dr. Henderson and Anita Bruce and Laura Quigley and all of that. This has been great. Leave webinar. Cha-ching. Cool. So that was the... Let's see, boys. No. Description. Building on the 2022 webinar, UBCM and the province will be hosting another one-hour heat preparedness webinar at 2 p.m. on May 23rd, 2023 for interested local government elected officials and staff members, representatives from the BC Centre for Disease Control and the BC Ministry of Health will deliver presentations on the following topics: review of 2021 heat dome and associated impacts, provincial heat preparedness initiatives, BC HARS, and health and climate resilience. Thank you for listening to the Green Antler Waterfall Podcast. This is Sarah Fowler, and it has been a Green Antler production. Bye-bye.